Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
This episode is brought to you by Somerset County Tourism. Hear stories from local brewers and distillers from the New Jersey Sip and See Trail on episode 647 of Beer Sessions Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone. I am Carlos Yescas. This is our second episode talking about one of my favorite topics, raw milk cheese. What is it and what is not? Recently, in episode 497, aired October 11, 2022, I talked to Mariano Gonzalez of Grafton Village Cheese Company about raw, thermalized, and pasteurized milk for cheese production in the United States. The production of raw milk cheese in North America is constantly under threat from the FDA and the CDC in the US, and by the extension by Health Canada north of the border, and the Zagarpa and COFEPRIS in Mexico. Antiquated regulations dating back to the 1960s still define what raw milk cheese is, what can be produced, imported, and sold. The environment of fear created by regulators and lawyers who profit from suing producers have made us all less safe. What is more detrimental is that many times U.S. regulations are exported and used as the basis to create local standards elsewhere. This is the case of raw milk regulation in the rest of the continent. The 60-day aging rule is an international standard for the Americas, and is currently applicable to producers from Alaska to Patagonia. Only recently, Brazil has started to look for a new standard, and we will hear about what's happening there in a future episode this season. In continental Europe, the story is a bit different. Raw milk production is also under threat, but standards allow for many more styles of cheese to be produced. But today, we are going to talk about the situation in England. And for that, I have one of the founders and current chair of the Royal Milk Producers Association. Yoni Crickmore is cheesemaker at Fenn Farm Dairy. He and his wife, Dulcie, began their cheesemaking journey back in 2013 after success in direct raw milk sales and introducing the milk vending machine concept in the UK. With a mission to make UK's first raw milk brie style cheese, inspired by the famous Brie d'Amont cheese from France, they went out to make Baron Bigod. Over the last 9 years, Johnny has helped build the business alongside working towards his goal of making the farm carbon negative over the coming years. He is also now vice chair for the Specialty Cheesemakers Association. Welcome to the show, Johnny.
Hi, Carlos.
Hi. I want to start today talking about your journey selling raw milk to become one of the most respected cheesemakers in the country. Can you tell us, have you always been involved in milk production?
Yeah. Yes. So it's my life, really. I've been a dairy farmer all my life, and I've been brought up on this farm where we are now. Fenn Farm Dairy. So in fact, I'm third generation dairy farmer. So for most of my life, up until when I became 31, we produced milk commercially and sold it to various sort of big processing companies over the years.
Nice. And so when did you decide that you wanted to make cheese? Or had you always made cheese on the side of the milk production?
No. I actually had absolutely no idea how to make cheese at all up until 2012. It started the whole diversification on the farm. It started from being frustrated and fed up with the industry as it was, and through my teens and my 20s when I finished school and started work on the farm, it was always this sort of negative vibe in the dairy industry in the UK of farmers not feeling like they were being paid enough, and seeing dairy farmers exit the industry. And then coupled with that, we were, in a position where our farm, where we'd started to breed our cows to Holstein, and I don't think the breed really fitted with the style of farming what we enjoyed doing. And it was a combination of all of these things sort of coming together, where in my late 20s I thought, no, this is just like this is not fun. I don't like enjoy getting up in the morning anymore. And we then went out looking, me and my wife Dulcie, for something else to do on our farm, which wasn't just totally reliant on milk being sold to a big milk processor. The story is quite long, but we looked into originally free range hen farming, but it was the free range hen farming where we come across this honesty box style shop at the actual farms. And it was so simple. It was just like a garden shed put near the end of the drive, near the road, and in it the free range hen farmers sold eggs. And I was amazed actually how many people were coming and buying these eggs. And I said as we went home to my wife Dulcie, I go, why don't we do that with raw milk? Or why don't we do that with milk? I didn't say raw milk at the time, it was just, why don't we do that with milk? And we thought, well, what have we got to lose? Like, let's buy ourselves a little garden shed, make it look attractive, let's paint it like a cow, and literally we'll just start bottling up milk from our herd of cows every morning, putting it in this little shed, and see what happened. And that's what really began our journey to where we are now.
Sounds like such a fantastic way of turning around a business. But so you mentioned that you had a type of cows, and then did you change the type of cows, or did you just maintain that, but just instead of selling to the market, you were just selling it as bottle for yourself?
Yeah, well, everything changed from that point, because with the little shed, it became, it was a great success and it was really rewarding. So we were putting in bottles of raw milk, and we thought we had a chance of like doing something different here, because you couldn't get a hold of raw milk, and you certainly couldn't buy it in the shops. And people kept coming back and they wrote in our comments book, oh, your milk tastes fantastic. I can't believe milk tastes like this. And it just sort of like all of a sudden, like, there was like the penny dropped. We realized all of a sudden, like, all this time we've been chasing for more milk, more liters, more yield from cow, quantity. We were trying to get quantity, when actually what we should do is actually focus on quality. And the breed of cow, the Holstein, it was just kind of always, it was just like, actually, we don't need to like if we don't enjoy this farming these style of cows, like just not do it. Like, people are buying this milk because it tastes good. So therefore, if you get cows where the milk quality is better, higher fats, higher proteins, more milk from grass, and then people are responding to quality. So, the next step was, we looked into doing other things with our milk other than just selling it through our little shed. And that's when the cheese idea came along. And that's when we looked into a different breed of cow with our herd.
Nice. And so what type of cow did you change to?
Well, with the cheese, it was the decision to make cheese which made us change our breed of cow. And the way that happened was we went on a sort of like a journey around the UK. Like at this point, we had no idea on cheese at all. I didn't know how to make it. I knew very little of the different varieties of cheese. But as we started to, we chose to visit people who were farmers and they made cheese. So they had, we had something in common with them, except for that we didn't make cheese. So we went on this journey, visited these farmers, and started to understand the British cheese industry, or the farmhouse British cheese industry, and then we started to learn more and more. We started to learn who these people were, where they sold their cheese to, mm-hmm. and then once we understood where the cheese went, we then contacted the cheese buyers, and these were a lot of the shops were in London, and one in particular, Neil's Yard Dairy. We contacted them and said, "Can we come and visit you? We're thinking about making cheese." They said, "Yeah, definitely, come over." And it was from that point we then saw like all of these British artisan cheeses on the counter in Neil's Yard Dairy, and in the middle there sat this like French cheese, the imposter. It's like, what is this doing here? And they said, well, no one really makes this type of cheese in the UK. No one makes a raw cow's milk brie. And it just like, it was like, that was it. You know, it's like, this is what we're here to do. This is our mission. We're going to make a cheese as good as Brie de Meaux, and we're going to like knock it off the shelf from the Neil's Yard Dairy counter. So the next thing what we did is like, how do we make a cheese as good as the French? Well, we really need to speak to someone who's French to start to learn from them. And we got in touch with this French cheesemaker called Yvan Larcher. And he was interested in working with us on this project. It sounded exciting. And he said, well, you know, if we're going to do it properly, what breed of cow have you got? And I said, Holstein. And he said, oh, well, you know, like he looked at the fats and the proteins of the milk, and he said, well, that's not really going to work. You've got to have like, you know, it starts with the animal. It starts with the cow, the milk. And, you know, you've got to get that bit right before the other bits come. So he suggested changing our breed of cow. So we changed, we went to France, because he was French and he knew the right breeds, for making the Brie de Meaux, and we eventually chose the Montbéliard cow, which is it's a popular cow in France for cheese making. The next thing, we were on this plane to the southwest of France, and southeast of France, in the Jura region, the Swiss French border, and we were going up and down these beautiful mountains, like going, stopping at small farms, buying these Montbéliard cows, all of which the milk went into cheese making, in particular Comté. We brought them back to the UK in 2012, and that's where was the beginning of the change of our herd.
Well, what a wonderful story. And here in the show, we have heard the name of Ivan Larcher many times, and we know that he has gone and tinkered with a lot of production. So this is a great story as well. And so I guess I have to ask, do you actually like this Brie style cheese? Did you like it when you tasted it there, or was it just really a commercial decision that, you know, we need to fill this gap?
I do genuinely. I mean, actually around that time, it's like once I started discovering cheeses, I was thinking, you know, it was like, oh my God, like what I've been missing all my life. It's like, this stuff is so good. So it just like, it doesn't matter at the end of the day, if the cheese is good, whatever variety is it's you just want to eat more of it. But I do genuinely like Brie, and I remember the Brie de Meaux, you know, tasting it, and, you know, I'd eaten Brie before, but nothing quite as delicious as that cheese. So I didn't mind at all. Once I got my focus on this this cheese to try and replicate, never looked back.
Nice. And I loved your cheese. And one of the things that I think a lot of people miss about this misunderstand about this cheese is that normally when we say that something is a brie style, we're talking about a cheese that is bloomy rind, and it has a production process. But you went all out and not only make the bloomy rind or the product, but you also went for a size that is the original size of brie. And I think that's so important in making this cheese. Was that a conscious decision of the size, or was it more a these are the sizes of molds that there are and it's just easier, as opposed to making maybe something smaller in size?
Yeah, I mean we just simply set our goal was to make the brie de meaux, and there was no there was no sort of there was anything what was going to stop us doing it that size, and in the same style and the same way of making it. We really didn't want to miss anything. I started to understand from listening to other cheesemakers that it's the detail. You mustn't check, the small stuff. If you start taking some of those, things out, the way you make it and the size it is, and then you won't get something as close to it. The 3 kilogram cheese is a hard cheese to make. It's definitely easier making smaller ones. I'm very proud that we stuck to doing it, because it wasn't easy in the beginning days. I do think the large cheeses, there is something quite special about them. I don't know. It's my favorite size is the 3 kilogram wheel.
Definitely. And I think that's why normally I don't like calling this cheese, other people call it brie style. And I'm like, that is just not, it's just not that it's following a style. It is actually a cheese that is following so much more than this. And I think that we need a better language to speak about your cheese as opposed to just referring to a brie style from England. what was the reception? You obviously had a sort of an entry with New York Yard Dairy, but what has been the sort of reception of other retailers, other people in England for your cheese?
It's been brilliant. I mean, right from the word go, involving Neil's Yard Dairy from the beginning, they started supporting us and buying it, and it wasn't easy to begin with. The cheese was inconsistent, and we didn't understand what we were doing very well. But it did have this, unique, different flavor, which wasn't or still isn't around in the UK, and it really wasn't hard to sell the cheese as the months progressed from when we started making it. More and more people found out about us, and we didn't go out advertising it. It just people discovered us, and I think it was just because we didn't go down the easy route. We did go, make a cheese which was the easiest cheese to make, and therefore made us more unique and made it more interesting. This single herd milk from Suffolk making a raw cow's milk brie. unique in itself, and it's just it just. It kept, once people bought it, they kept coming back to buy it. And it's been that case ever since, really. It's become a sort of a key cheese to have on your counter, it seems, in the UK now for delis and farm shops. And the people we choose to sell to as well. We could have sold to so many more customers, but we chose to sell to a certain crowd of people, and I think that, you know, being us being loyal to them as they've been loyal back again.
Definitely. Do you have a sense if at the beginning people were more excited that it was a brie style made in England, or that it was a raw milk cheese as well? Or do you think it was, you know, all sort of the same package?
Yeah, that's a hard one to truly say. I think that the story to begin with was exciting, and it was enough to lure people in and to get cheese, you know, buyers, wholesalers to at least give it a go and try. So, yeah, it was a combination, I think, of being a raw milk brie, but also being like a dairy farmer making cheese. And actually, there isn't that many of us who do that. There isn't many, even though we've got a great like growing cheese industry, artisan cheese industry in the UK. There isn't that many of us who are truly farmers who make cheese on their farm. So, you know, so I think it's a combination of several things. What got people interested in the cheese to begin with?
And so, you make raw milk cheese every day, or is that a decision that you have to make sort of day by day?
It's just really mostly down to the quantity required at the time of the year. You know, like Christmas time, we're making 7 days a week, so that's right now. There are times of the year when we just don't have enough milk, and we just make everything into cheese, and the other products then suffer. It is about just really about supply and demand. I mean, there is only so far we can go, and we're aware of that. And we don't intend to buy in other milk to make our cheese. It is always going to be from Fen Farm. So we've set ourselves rules which we don't want to break.
That's good. What other products do you make on top of Baron Biot?
So we make a butter, a cultured raw milk butter called Bungay butter, named after our little town where our farm is based. And that product came around from a few years after the cheese, that there seemed to be a lot of our customers who we sell to in London buy French Normandy butter, butter from Brittany as well. You know, again, it sort of like raised the question as like, you know, why can't, if you're going to France to buy this butter because you think it's better than what we're making in the UK, like, you know, why is that? You know, there's no reason we can't do something like that too. So that was another sort of mission what we had. In its own right, Bungay butter is has grown over the years, and it regularly gets sort of mentioned in national newspapers as sort of the best premium brand butter. We've got a lot of celebrity fans who can't not have it in their fridges.
I'm sure you're benefiting right now from the butter boards that are everywhere.
The butter boards.
Oh, you don't know them? They're all over TikTok.
No.
I will send you after the show a video because I think they're very interesting. Oh. I'm sure our listeners know exactly what I'm talking about, and they'll be very happy to also share their butter boards.
Oh, I'm going to have to. I just don't get off the farm much, so I don't know much of what's going on TikTok. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah, please do. Send it over.
All right. This sounds like a great moment to take a break. We'll be right back after listening from our sponsors.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Comté within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Comté. Comté takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineurs on average, each wheel of Comté is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Comté is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Comté is unique. Learn more about Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
I'm Jimmy Carboni, host of Beer Sessions Radio on HRN. I recently hosted a live podcasting event with local beer and spirits makers from beautiful Somerset County, New Jersey. We spoke on the farm that is home to Flounder Brewery and Belmar Distillery, one of the most beautiful stops along the Sip and See craft beverage trail.
To me, those two worlds, brewery and distillery, are extremely complementing businesses, especially in a unique location like this. So it immediately helped this become a destination to have a great experience, whether it's the beer atmosphere we've got going in here in the old barns or the great experience you can have in there with these incredible cocktails that are created there. It's complementary to each other. You can have two completely different experiences all within a 10-foot walk from each other.
Before the event, I was able to tour the area and see the historic Bridge Tender's House along the serene DNR Canal, walk the bike and hiking trails, and take in the lush farmland. Then we settled into the centuries-old Dutch barn turned brewery for a lively discussion.
It was always important for us to create our space, our livelihood that we want to share with everybody else, of being a community-centric location. It is what makes us a brewery in this state different from a barn or restaurant. We're obviously family-friendly here. We have a lot of different groups that have their meetings here during the week. We just really want to become a community hub.
You can listen to this episode of Beer Sessions Radio, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again to Somerset County Tourism for supporting this episode. Learn more about the Sip and See Passport Program at visitsomersetnj.org. That's visit SOMERSETNJ.org.
All right, we are back. I'm Carlos Yescas, and I'm today with Johnny Crickmore. We have been talking about his journey from milk producer to cheesemaker, and now we're going to take a bit of a turn to start talking about the work that Johnny does with the Raw Milk Producers Association and what is happening in the UK in that space. So, Johnny, can you tell us about this organization that you help start, and what are the aims of it?
Yeah, so the Raw Milk Producers Association, we're now around five years probably from the original idea, and it came about from this sort of popular movement, you know, a growing movement of dairy farmers producing raw milk from their herds. Now we're going sort of 10 years back. And I think, you know, with the UK, the rules and regulations around raw drinking milk is rather peculiar, and they don't always make sense. And we're at this period of time where there was illnesses related to raw drinking milk, and it was becoming quite worrying, where this was going. And we were a few of us who produce raw milk were getting worried that the Food Standards Agency in the UK were probably going to ban it. So that would be a really bad thing for not only raw drinking milk, but also for raw milk cheeses and raw milk dairy products. because once, you know, one was banned, there was the chance that it could roll on to the next products. So we discussed the idea. That was myself and Bronwyn Percival from Neal's Yard Dairy, that that the best thing to do is actually go get in touch with the Food Standards Agency and go and meet them in London and just talk about it. And it seems quite straightforward, really, but I suppose, like, you always think it's us against them. But on this situation, once we actually met with them, it really wasn't. And they genuinely wanted to just really help sort the situation out and try and get it so that people could still get access to raw milk. But it didn't have at the time, you know, illnesses related to it. So we came about with this idea of, like, let's just invite everybody who produces raw milk to a day in somewhere in the central part of the UK where we could all meet and just talk about it and, like, come up with a solution. And exactly what we did. And we got a huge amount of the producers around the UK came to that meeting that day. And we proposed this idea of setting up a producers group, which would be there to help raw milk producers in any issues what they were having at the time. Someone you could come to and in confidence discuss your problems, and also to be there as a something to, you know, to educate our members, so we could we learned safe ways of producing raw milk, and that's when the Raw Milk Producers Association was created. And we since then we've got a good 2/3 of the UK's raw milk producers as members, and it's been a great success. Any related illnesses is at the moment, touch wood, there isn't any, and there hasn't been for a good year and a half connected with raw milk in the UK, which has been a great success. And it's just down to sharing information with each other, and also working with the Food Standards Agency. So they're the regulator, we're the producer, and having that good relationship where at the end of the day we're just trying to get the same outcome, it's working well, and the Food Standards Agency look at it as a great success from their part as well.
That's so refreshing to hear, especially for someone coming from the US and North America, that, you know, you can go and talk to the regulator and they want to help out. That's always what we have learned, that, you know, in the UK, the system may be a bit better than what we have on the other side of the ocean. What was your, as you said, you know, you went, tried to talk to them. What was sort of your final aim for that meeting? Just to establish a connection, or were you hopeful that they will help you create standards and all this?
Yeah, I mean, it really was the original meeting was just to get a bit of a feeling of, like, you know, just get the feeling of, like, the people at the FSA, you know, where were they, you know, what sort of vibe were they going to give off. And so we really didn't know. I mean, we could have sat down with a bunch of people who were going to tell us that raw milk is evil and all milk should be pasteurized, raw milk should be banned. We could have had the same conversation. But thankfully, the people are quite open-minded. I think the good thing about the Food Standards Agency in the UK is that the majority of the people behind it understand that people need to, people should be given choices. It's just that they need to be explained to, like, the risks around things, because every food has got a risk in some shape or form. You just need to be told about it, really. As long as you're aware of what you're doing, then that should be fine. Where it goes wrong, the worst thing is when you do ban it, because then you get the wrong kind of people going into the industry, producing this stuff. I suppose you call it the black market, wouldn't you? So, which is the wrong approach. It should be, allowed for anyone to produce it, but then under a certain sort of set of regulations.
Right. No, and I think that's so important, that those two things that you just said. One is that, consumers need to understand and give them the choice and, the proper information, but also that the regulator should be open to having these conversations. Do you have a sense that the proverbial question here, that anything may change because of Brexit? There was before a very welcoming space in Europe, but now the UK trying to get into a trade agreement with the United States may create a pressure from the other side to change regulation.
Yeah, it's really quite hard to tell that right now. I think we are a little bit worried that, that coming out of Europe, that things could change for the worse. But it's hard, Carlos, to truly say at the moment. I mean, when you're, previously when we were, had stronger connections with, say, like France and some of the other sort of, bigger raw milk cheese producing countries, then I felt that would have been only a strong place to be, but we just got to like work hard on it and get our point across. But at the moment, I think we're in an okay position.
Well, that is very encouraging, especially since the current Prime Minister wants to sell more British cheese in the world, and as we all know, for our listeners in the US, this cheese will be one of those cheeses that only coming to the UK they'll be able to taste. Do you think it's a disservice to your own sort of cheese that this cannot be exported somewhere else? And is that a feeling of all the producers of raw milk cheese in the UK?
Yeah, it's a tough one. With the regulations in the US, to be quite honest, it's difficult in the distance as well for the soft cheeses, for the time it takes to get from the UK to the US. Sometimes life just isn't fair, is it? I don't know enough about the sort of the feel with the FDA and the US, whether there's anything like that going to change in the future. But we are hopeful that in some shape or form that we can get our cheese to the US at some point, even if we ended up making it in the US. There does seem... It seemed like such a shame because I've been to the US. I love going to the US and on holiday. And I, every time I go there, I always feel like there's always this gap which doesn't seem to be filled by anybody in the US of making a cheese like us. So I don't know. Watch this space.
Fantastic. That's very hopeful way to get into that. And I guess my last question for the day, it will be, what do you hope is the future for raw milk cheese production in the UK, raw milk cheese consumption in the UK? Do you think it's a brighter future at the moment?
I do. I think it's a great future for it's a growing industry in the UK for raw milk cheeses and as year on year, the field between ourselves and our sort of fellow raw milk cheese producers is that our sales are going up and growing. it's not an industry which is going to like explode, because it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to go into. You have to have a certain sort of set of criteria which for you to do, say, like the likes of what we're doing at the farm. You've either got to be the farmer, which becomes difficult because you have to, you know, change the thing what you do. You're a farmer, you know, all of a sudden you've got to be a food producer. And to do both of those is quite a challenge, quite a different mindset. And then there's the other option, which is you as the cheesemaker can partner up with a farmer and make cheese on that farm. But then again, that is difficult because the farmer's probably in a long-term contract with a milk buyer. So it's not an easy thing to go into. There's a huge amount of capital investment to, you know, to start up from fresh. And then, like, you could, the other argument of coming into this is like, you know, I'll just buy a few cows and a small holding, and then I'll start making cheese. But then the problem comes is that you don't have a life anymore, because all you do is like milk cows and make cheese, because the cows have to be milked twice a day. So it, from all angles, it's not an easy thing to come into. It's incredibly rewarding when you get there. But so what I'm in summary is that there is a great opportunity in the UK, and we need more cheesemakers. But it's something which is incredibly challenging to get into and to actually get it to a size which it's a viable business. It's not easy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not. But I think you are leaving us here with some hope that at least the consumers is out there waiting for the product. And if people were willing to go into everything that you and Dulce have done, you know, there is a market out there for these products.
Yeah, no doubt about it. There's demand is there. It's you've got to have the appetite to take on the challenge as the harvest bin.
Definitely. Well, I thank you today, Johnny, for everything, for your time and your knowledge sharing it with us. I'm sure that our listeners in the U.S. Will be very happy to hear your story, and hopefully we'll get to come to the U.K. and try taste your cheese.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carlos.
This is it for today. We will be back next month talking about Brazilian cheeses for the season. I thank you for listening, and remember to follow Cutting the Curd and the Heritage Radio Network wherever you your social media. Thank you. Bye.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.